am Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Continuing to read from presidential historian Michael Betschloss's Presidents of War and his essay on Lyndon Baines Johnson and the Vietnam War, we pick up the story on July 28, 1965, where Lyndon Johnson, at a press conference, informs the public of his decision to increase the fighting strength in Vietnam from 75,000 to 125,000 men. Revealing his ambivalence during the press conference, Johnson confessed, "I do not find it easy to send the flower of our finest young men into battle. This is the most agonizing and the most painful duty of your president. But unless the nation stood up against men who hate and destroy, then all our dreams for freedom, all will be swept away on the flood of conquest. So, too, this shall not happen. We shall stand in Vietnam." A reporter asked him how long the war would take. President Johnson replied that there would be no quick solution, adding that after Pearl Harbor, no one really knew whether World War II would take 2 years or 4 years or 6 years. Asked when he might ask Congress for a war declaration, the president replied, "That would depend on the circumstances." During a speech the following week, Johnson gave no hint of his private doubts about the war and told the crowd, "America wins the war that she undertakes. Make no mistake about it." In early September 1965 at the LBJ Ranch in Texas, Johnson suffered a gallbladder attack. "No one ever knows till they get it behind them," the president explained to Attorney General Robert Kennedy during a phone call. "They think it might rupture if I don't get it taken care of." Throughout his life, Johnson had broken down at times of emotional distress. Late in his first House of Representatives campaign, in a 1937 special election, Johnson had suffered from severe stomach pains, but refused to be hospitalized until doctors warned that his appendix was about to rupture. Campaigning for the U.S. Senate in May 1948, suffering from kidney stones, he was secretly flown to the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, after which, as Lady Bird Johnson, his wife, recalled, he was depressed and it was bad. This time, his recovery from surgery was so slow and painful that he asked Abe Fortas, his friend and soon-to-be Supreme Court Justice, what the procedure would be if he quit the presidency and had the new justice draft a resignation letter for him. Johnson spent most of the last 3 months of 1965 on his ranch in Texas. He told aides that he had decided to stop drinking so that night or day his mind would be clear should he have to issue a sudden order affecting my boys in Vietnam. After the president's July 1965 escalation announcement, former President Dwight Eisenhower advised him through his one-time White House Staff Secretary General Andrew Goodpaster that he should have avoided using specific numbers because it told the enemy that we are limited in our determination. Instead, Eisenhower said, Johnson should have said, "We will do whatever is needed." Ike said this was no time for piddling steps. Instead, they should swamp North Vietnam now. But Johnson was committed to his defense secretary's strategy of gradual escalation. In November 1965, the Joint Chiefs of Staff came to the West Wing, asking Johnson for 113,000 more troops, a naval blockade of the North, isolation of its vital port of Haiphong, and a B-52 bombing assault against Hanoi. According to a briefer for the Marines, Charles Cooper, who was present, Johnson exploded, denouncing the Joint Chiefs as shitheads, dumb shits, and pompous assholes, making free use of the F word. He warned that he wouldn't let military idiots talk him into World War III, and finally ordered them to get the hell out of the room. Afterward, Johnson's Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral David McDonald, told Cooper, "This has got to be the worst experience I could ever imagine." By December, the president was angry again at Vice President Hubert Humphrey, who had indiscreetly told reporters what kind of concessions by the enemy might move the president to relax the war. Johnson fulminated to his aide, Mac Bundy, "I've cautioned that boy 7 times, and this morning. Every paper is full of all the trades he's going to propose. He's a fool." Remembering what had befallen his old chief, former President Truman, in Korea, his aide, Clark Clifford, told Johnson, "Where the hell are we going in Vietnam?" complaining that further and further into this war, there seemed no prospect of a return. The president confided to his defense secretary, Robert McNamara, "I've had little sympathy with Senator Fulbright, but I don't see any light down that barrel. We're getting deeper and deeper in. I bogged my car down." In January 1966, Johnson planned to ask Congress for about $12 billion to support the Vietnam fighting. Complaining to Larry O'Brien, now Postmaster General of the United States, Johnson observed that, compared with his own days as a strict majority leader of the Senate, senators were running wild. "Senator Mac Mansfield sits back like a pious priest by God. When Senator Fulbright roared, Senator Mansfield would crawl under the bed." Of his soldiers in Vietnam, Johnson blustered, "I'm not going to withdraw them. They can undercut them all they want to. They can raise hell. They don't need to appropriate. We can just leave them there hungry and take up voluntary contributions." Trying to contain Johnson's war, Senator Wayne Morse of Oregon asked the Senate to rescind the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which authorized the escalation of the war. Senator Fulbright warned Dean Rusk, Secretary of State, that before we can approve these large sums of money, it must be understood that neither that resolution nor the CETO treaty, often cited by the administration, provided sufficient legal basis for the fighting in Vietnam. Senator Fulbright publicly apologized for not having been foresighted and wise in pushing the Tonkin Gulf resolution document through the Senate. Johnson complained to Larry O'Brien, Postmaster General, that Senator Fulbright had tried to destroy every president he had ever served with, stating, "He's only interested in the New York Times." Using his gift for mimicry, Johnson imitated the Arkansan harassing Dean Rusk during a hearing, "What you don't want to be responsive." He told Hubert Humphrey, as vice president, he had heard that the Arkansan, Senator Fulbright, was going through a menopause or was off his rocker because his wife had been ailing. Johnson insisted, "It's easier to satisfy Ho Chi Minh than it is Senator Fulbright." Attorney General Robert Kennedy was growing more alarmed about the war. In a Senate floor speech, he warned that, "If we regard bombing as the answer to Vietnam, we are heading straight for disaster." By telephone, Senator Russell of Georgia warned Johnson against getting into a debate with that little pissant. The president told Secretary of State Rusk that Kennedy's speech was tragic and so presumptuous. The Secretary of State replied, "I think it has greatly weakened our position with Hanoi and prolongs the war, actually." His anxieties aroused, Johnson warned, "It means a majority in the Senate against us, Rusk." He feared that the spies of Idaho and the tidings of Delaware and the two Kennedys and the Muskies, the general Catholic operation there, when the chips are down, they will pick up enough cases and perhaps a Javits of New York. Johnson refused suggestions to ask for a new congressional expression of support for the war. Drawing on information provided by Nicholas Katzenbach, whom he had by now appointed as Attorney General of the United States, he asked Secretary of State Dean Rusk to remind Congress that throughout American history, there are 160 times the president has gone in without a declaration of war to protect the interests of the United States. The president has this constitutional power. Rusk replied, "The figure I have is 125, Mr. President." "I don't care," said Johnson. just assert that he has it. We have an obligation. And the president wouldn't be worthy of his salt if he didn't do it, or else why have a treaty? He had asked for the Tonkin Gulf resolution, he said, because he knew that members of Congress would run when the going gets tough, and wanted them tied, bound, and delivered beforehand. He recalled warning Congress in 1964 that he would not pee a drop unless they gave him a resolution to act in Vietnam. Now, if they want to surrender to the communists, then repeal it. Even if the members did so, he would go on fighting in Vietnam because as commander-in-chief, he had that power anyway. Unburdening himself, Johnson confided to Secretary Rusk that, with the Kennedy infiltration all over the place, he was afraid that members would say that we ought to sit down with the Viet Cong, and that Bobby Kennedy's statement may have been paving the way. He lamented that Americans did not seem to comprehend why they had to fight in Vietnam, stating, "When you just say it once on television, that doesn't get through to them. You got to repeat it like Hitler did, 20 times. Then maybe they do." He recalled that a few days before, Secretary of Defense McNamara had estimated that we only have one chance out of three of winning the war. It just shocked me, and furthermore, it shocked everybody at the table. With cattiness, Secretary Rusk said of the ex-Ford Motor Chief Robert McNamara, "Quite frankly, Mr. President, he hasn't had too much experience in dealing with crises." Johnson told Senator Mike Mansfield of Montana that diluting the Tonkin Gulf resolution would mean, "I'm in hell of a shape as commander of chief. If we leave me in doubt, hell, I'd rather turn the authority over to Senator Fulbright." He told Senator Eugene McCarthy of Minnesota, who is bridling against the war, "I can't get out. I just can't be the architect of surrender. They don't have the pressure that would bring them to the table as of yet. We don't know if they ever will. I'm willing to do damn near anything." Others proposed that Johnson defy custom and testify in some fashion before Congress, but the president asked Russell Long to call this idea out of bounds. "Just say, since George Washington came down there and got in a goddamn row, that no president's been back since. This is a lot of crap about Johnson. He's refusing to testify." Even more worried about Robert Kennedy, the Attorney General, the president warned Henry Luce, the militant Time Life Fortune founder, that Bobby Kennedy is sniping from the sidelines. Now what he is doing is playing a little politics 1968. Johnson went on to complain that some anti-war senators were attempting to load the Tonkin Gulf resolution with namby-pamby conditions, stating, "I think it's very bad to have a committee fighting a war, a Civil War committee." Johnson wondered aloud what to do if Westmoreland, commanding general of the forces in Vietnam, asked him for 50,000 more soldiers by September, and by then a majority of the United States is against escalation. Johnson asked Henry Luce, "What does a man do that doesn't want to be a dictator, that just wants to do what's right?" The president suspected that secret Chinese and Soviet agents were lurking behind some of the U.S. senators and news people turning against his war. In April 1965, 16,000 protesters, sponsored by Women Strike for Peace, Students for a Democratic Society, and other groups, had marched against the war to the Washington Monument. Johnson told Senator Gale McGee, Democrat from Wyoming, that J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI, had brought him the files at night and was very upset about it. The communist agents were going into the colleges and the faculties and the student bodies and urging that we have a ceasefire or stop our bombing, hoping to bring pressure on us here to throw in the towel. The president assured Senator McGee, "Hoover's got most of these groups infiltrated." Johnson claimed to Attorney General Katzenbach that he was a red-hot 1,002% civil liberties man, and "I'm against wiretapping, period." In practice, he directed that such surveillance be brought to an irreducible minimum, but not in cases of national security, which he defined in his own way, deciding that his political foes were among grave threats to the Republic. In March 1966, he asked his FBI liaison, Kartha Deke Deloach, to have Hoover tighten the Bureau's watch on Eastern Bloc contacts with opinion molders, especially in Congress. He said, "It scares hell out of me to learn that Chinese communists gave $3,000 to somebody who was talking to Senator Morris, after which Senator Morris would speak out against the war on the Senate floor." He noted that Fulbright had once dined with the Soviet ambassador Anatoly Dobrynin until after midnight, and the next day he's examining Secretary Rusk. "That scares me." After consulting Hoover, who hated Martin Luther King Jr., Johnson told his aide, Mack Bundy, that the civil rights leader was not a communist, but was completely controlled by them. He pushed the CIA to go beyond its charter, which excluded internal security, to investigate foreign manipulation of racial disturbances and anti-war organizations, and did the same with Army intelligence. As Johnson's CIA director, Richard Helms, told me, the author, in 1989, the president pressed him almost daily for evidence that foreign communists were secretly in charge of the campus protests, but Director Helms kept coming up dry. In the Oval Office, Johnson warned six state governors about communist subservience in America, stating, "Don't kid yourself a moment. It is in the highest councils of government, in our society. Joseph McCarthy's methods were wrong, but the threat is greater now than in his day." With Johnson's approval, his close aide, Marvin Watson, a steely Texan and ex-Marine, asked FBI Deputy Director Deke Deloach to put a surveillance on a Chicago Daily News reporter, Pete Lizagor, to find out what he was doing and where he is getting his information. Deloach refused, telling Watson that to monitor Lizagor, who had not been accused of any crime, would bring considerable discredit not only on the FBI, but the president himself. Lady Bird Johnson reminded her husband that the files that so absorbed him have a lot of unevaluated information in them, accusations and gossip which haven't been proven. By the spring of 1966, the campuses were erupting in protest. Johnson asked his advisors why Americans who dissent can't do their dissenting in private, claiming you have to go back to the Civil War to find this public dissent. In May, at a large Democratic banquet in Chicago, hosted by his friend, Mayor Richard Daley, President Johnson openly questioned the patriotism of those who opposed the war, stating, "There will be some nervous Nellies, and some who will become frustrated and bothered and break ranks under the strain, and some will turn on their leaders and on their country and on our own fighting men." His false public optimism about ultimate victory in Vietnam caused critics like Walter Lippmann to charge Johnson with a deliberate policy of artificial manipulation of official news. Americans derided Johnson's credibility gap. The Joint Chiefs of Staff proposed expanding the bombing of the North Vietnam to include petroleum, oil, and lubricant facilities and transport lines. "What might I be asked next?" Johnson replied. "Destroy industry? Disregard human life? Suppose I say no. What else would you recommend?" General Wheeler replied, "Mining Haiphong." The chiefs of staff assured him that their suggested new attacks would not draw Moscow or Beijing into the war. Johnson shot back, "Are you more sure than MacArthur was in Korea?" General Wheeler insisted, "This is different," noting that in Korea, we had ground forces moving to the Yalu River. Johnson asked, "Any warnings you want to give me before I go to commune with myself and my God?" Hearing none, the president soon approved the chief's request. That fall, Johnson told former President Eisenhower, "I'm trying to win it just as fast as I can in every way that I know how." Ike replied that this war was the most nasty and unpredictable thing we've ever been in. During a Pacific tour in late October, Johnson made a surprise trip to South Vietnam. For reasons of security, he spent only 2.5 hours there, but moved closer to actual battle than any president since Lincoln at Fort Stevens in 1864. At the U.S. base of Cam Ranh Bay, standing tall in an open Jeep, clutching its safely railing, he wore a tan-colored ranch suit and brown tie, riding with General Westmoreland past a crowd of soldiers. "Some seemed to think that he should be treated like a general," said one reporter, until he extended his hand, and they rushed forward almost like any street corner crowd back home. Doffing his jacket, in his short-sleeved shirt, Johnson told individual troops, "Y'all come back safe and sound now, and chin up, chest out, we're going to get out of this yet." In the officer's mess, he told a lieutenant, "Quite a number of women you got there. You're a lucky man." Johnson died on ham, roast pork, and mashed potatoes in the mess hall, pinned medals on troops, and consoled the wounded lying in constant huts. General Thee, Kai, and Westmoreland sat by the president as he addressed an honor guard from a platform on an aluminum runway. His face glowing with sweat, Johnson told them, "There are some who may disagree with what we're doing here, but that is not the way most of us feel and act when freedom and the nation's security are in danger." Almost choking up, Johnson said, "I could not begin to thank every man in Vietnam for what he is doing. He pledged, 'We shall never let you down,' and that one day the whole world will acknowledge that what you have done here was worth the price." Before leaving Vietnam, Johnson called out, using the language of the American frontier, "Be sure to come home with that coonskin on the wall." In that fall's midterms, Richard Nixon campaigned far and wide for his party, criticizing Johnson's medal on Vietnam. Nixon traveled on a borrowed Learjet, previously used by the villain in the title role of the 1964 James Bond film Goldfinger, and flown by the character Pussy Galore. At a press conference 4 days before the election in 1966, Johnson scorned former Vice President Nixon as a chronic campaigner. Nixon responded in a paid broadcast by asking whether every public figure who questioned Johnson's handling of Vietnam would become the victim of a presidential attack to silence his dissent. Johnson called Senator Fulbright and asked him, despite their differences, to take on Brother Nixon for his waffling on Vietnam, stating, "One day he wants to escalate the war, and the next day he wants to de-escalate it. Sounds like he wants to permanently occupy the country and keep the boys there ad infinitum. Just ridicule him a little." Voters, dissatisfied with Johnson's advances on civil rights and other domestic affairs, as well as the stalemate in Vietnam, helped Republicans to gain 47 seats in the House and 3 U.S. Senate seats. The Democrats retained control of both houses, but Nixon rightly called it the sharpest rebuff of a president in a generation. In the aircraft hangar of his ranch, Johnson insisted to reporters that when the pendulum swings one way, as it did in 1964, pretty strongly it has a tendency to swing back. In February 1967, Johnson brooded over how to renew the conscription law, which would expire that year. Early in the Vietnam escalation, he had abruptly canceled President John F. Kennedy's insistence that married men, especially those with children, be called up last. Johnson was worried that too much of the war was being fought by African Americans, Latinos, and other minorities, thanks largely to exemptions and 4,100 mostly white draft boards. He wished to go down in history as a liberator of black Americans, not their executioner. He named a commission on the draft, which proposed an end to deferments for college and graduate students, save those in medical and dental schools, increased diversity in the selective service system, a lottery, and a new policy for 19-year-olds to be summoned first. The president knew that canceling deferments would stimulate new campus protests against his war. Congress indeed extended the draft, but defied his wish to end college deferments and chose draftees more randomly, as in the days of old, by lottery. That February, Newsweek and the New York Times reported that during a trip to Paris, Robert Kennedy had received a peace feeler from Hanoi suggesting that the enemy might negotiate if Johnson stopped the bombing. Sure that Kennedy himself had leaked the news, the president was furious. As Kennedy later told his staff during a visit to the Oval Office, "Johnson started right in by getting mad at me for leaking the story." Kennedy had denied it and said he was unsure that there had been a peace feeler, but the leak had probably come from your State Department. Johnson shouted, "It's not my State Department, it's your goddamn State Department." By Kennedy's account, the president had told him that within 6 months the war would end with a military victory, and I'll destroy you and every one of your dove friends. Kennedy urged him to say that you'll stop the bombing if he'll come to the negotiating table. Johnson replied, "There isn't a chance in hell that I will do that." He shouted at the senator, "You have blood on your hands." Nicholas Katzenbach, who was present, later recalled that he had never seen the president like this, irrational and almost totally out of control. Furious, Kennedy rose to his feet and told Johnson, "I don't have to take it from you. I'm leaving." Reading from presidential historian Michael Beschloss's essay on Lyndon Baines Johnson and the Vietnam War in his book, Presidents of War Will Be Continued. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer leader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.